our society, no matter what we do, is not going to look anything like it did before once all of this is over. So recognizing that we're in a moment of transformation, I think the most important thing, and you know, what PRISM is trying to do, is be a platform for people of color who are at the intersections of some of these things, you know, being most impacted by the pandemic, being at the forefront of the uprisings, to really be the ones who are leading the process of envisioning what the future needs to look like.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. PRISM is a nonprofit news outlet that does something we need more of. It centers people who are currently underreported by national media as the experts on their own fights for justice. The site is partnered with Daily Kos, so it has significant reach. I spoke recently with Ashton Lattimore, PRISM's editor-in-chief. Ashton seems to be a really great fit for PRISM, and she brings a lot of relevant experience. After Trump's election, she began a move from the practice of law toward her original interest in journalism in order to be more involved politically. Ashton is a product of Harvard College, the Columbia School of Journalism, and Harvard Law School, where she was an editor of the Harvard Law Review. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Ashton Lattimore and PRISM.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Ashton, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. I'm Ashton Lattimore. I'm the editor-in-chief of PRISM. Quick biography. Let's see, how can I sum up my story? I'm basically a journalist turned lawyer turned journalist again. So I grew up in Central Jersey, went to college up in Massachusetts. And at that point, you know, I joined the college newspaper and I was kind of off and running. After that, went to journalism school at Columbia, worked in New York as the editor at News One for a year before I decided to head off to law school. Went to law school, practiced law for about 4 years. And then shortly after the events of 2016, really felt called to return to the journalism field and kind of jump back into the fray and really try to do some important kind of narrative shifting work and just be a presence and a voice for people of color, women of color in this space. And now I'm here at PRISM, and that's what we do.
That makes sense. And I honor the way you gave that biography as a Yalie, not mentioning the Harvard undergrad, Harvard Law School, and Harvard Law editor for the review there. I think that's, I'll just mention it for you.
Oh, thank you. I tried not to do the classic, you know, I went to school in Boston
kind of. Yeah, but I know it's always tricky for me too. I know it's a long time ago and you know, it only goes so far. I am interested in sort of understanding that career a little bit more, just as background to what you're doing right now. So tell me a little bit about kind of the family you grew up in, and were they political? Were they interested in the kind of stuff that you're doing now?
My mother's very political. She's, you know, she's always the one who's kind of got the TV going with all, you know, the commentators and everything in the background. And she was always talking to me about politics and kind of what was going on in the world. She worked for various different banks, you know, growing up as a mortgage underwriter, and that's what she does now. My dad, I don't think of him as political, but it's interesting. He's actually a retired police officer. So he spent his entire career in the police department in Plainfield, New Jersey, you know, rising up through the ranks there, eventually becoming a captain, working in kind of internal affairs. So kind of watching that career unfold and having some window into the lives of police officers. I think it informs my work right now in an interesting way, given all the conversation going on around criminal justice. That's my parents, and it was just them and me. I don't have any siblings, and grew up in suburban New Jersey, so not too far from New York geographically, but light years away in terms of culture and things to do.
I've got to imagine that having a dad who's police captain in this moment where there are calls for defunding the police and all these years of trouble, it has got to be a really valuable window. How do you see that helping you choose what to put in Prism or how to think or write about that topic?
I find it really, really valuable. And the other kind of complicating factor is that we typically, in a lot of media, it's framed very much as sort of Black folks versus the police. I'm a Black woman, my father's a Black man and a police officer. So that complicates the narrative a bit, but in a way that I think is valuable, for nuance, understanding that there are Black people who are part of these systems and they can be part of the same oppressive forces that function in the ways of Black people as a whole. It's really not about individual officers. It's a system. It's an entire system. And the fact that my father worked in internal affairs for as long as he did, I kind of know there are many, many good police, but the system as a whole certainly can be fertile ground for things like corruption, for things like abuses. I mean, that's why internal affairs departments need to exist. So as it informs my work, I think it helps me to have a more nuanced understanding of the relationship between Black folks and the police. I don't think it's always kind of a strictly oppositional relationship. It's something that's family to family, neighborhood to neighborhood that can vary. But then also coming at it with a very, I won't say jaundiced view, but certainly not naive about, what police are and the kinds of things that they can do. That's what I bring to it. We have a criminal justice reporter, Tamar, who leads off our coverage, and she does a fantastic job. So I just kind of play the background, but these are the things that I spend a lot of my time thinking about, especially in the midst of this particular moment.
Tell me about that journalism, lawyer journalism path. It's not an unusual back and forth, and certainly your legal education and experience has to be valuable, highly valuable in being a journalist. But what attracts you to one and the other, and why did you land where you did?
So journalism, that was an easy path for me to follow, at least initially. I've been a writer since I was, in fifth grade, probably even before then. So, I tried various different outlets for it. I wrote short stories and, I wrote terrible poetry as a teenager. But then when I came to campus at Harvard and joined the campus newspaper right off the bat and joined the op-ed page first, I really felt like I found my voice and was able to use it in service of the larger campus community, especially the Black community on campus. A lot of what I wrote about, was race, culture, gender, writing in service of women, Black women, even then, and really feeling like it was valuable and important to have a platform in that way, and rising through the ranks at the newspaper and eventually becoming an editor, and then using that position to make sure that other Black folks on campus had a platform, that they got columns and they got op-ed space and things like that. That really felt like a natural home for me, just journalism being a way to use my own voice in service of racial justice, gender justice, and also help lift up other folks' voices as well as an editor. So, I went to journalism school just kind of following up on what I'd always been doing right after college. But as it happens, I graduated college in 2008 and graduated journalism school in 2009. So by that point, the economy was in free fall. The journalism industry was in free fall. There were mass layoffs. There were publications that were just folding up, going away. It didn't feel like a terribly stable industry to stay in. And it's not, even to this day, known to be a particularly financially rewarding industry. And this is someone, who's living in New York. It's one of the most expensive cities in the world. So then, family members, being kind of responsible adults, decide to, put law school in my ear as an option. And I think this happens to a lot of people who are writers. Law school is framed as kind of a responsible, stable way to be an outlet for that kind of work. legal careers involve a lot of reading, a lot of writing. So it does allow you to flex some of the same muscles, but in a much more kind of career stable way. You know, you go to law school and depending on which law school you go to, you're kind of put on a conveyor belt to some of the best law firms in the world, and you get put in the firms and then you rise up through the ranks. And it's all very orderly in a way that journalism careers tend not to be. So it felt like a safe thing to do and useful because understanding the law and our legal systems are just a useful way to understand the way different systems function and dysfunction in this country, which I certainly bring to my work now. So yeah, I did it. I went to law school and I enjoyed it. You know, I enjoyed the school experience. I enjoyed the law review experience. And, you know, then I start practicing and, you know, it's lots and lots of billing hours and reviewing documents and reading cases. And there was occasionally kind of a satisfying moment in there, but ultimately it's just not what I wanted to do. The practice of law can be very quiet, and it made me feel very quiet in a way that I wasn't able to use my voice and lift up other voices in the way that had become really important to me. And then after, you know, 2016 and seeing what happened there, just I felt really called to kind of jump back into the fray.
So there's really a through line for you from that campus newspaper to Prism. What I know about Harvard Law is from reading the book 1L. Did you ever read that?
I actually never did. People talk about it all the time. Yeah. I carefully did not read it.
It's fairly intimidating about the first year and the intensity of that experience. Was it like that for you?
It was fairly intense because it's just a different way of learning. It's a different way of reading. Cases are not really like anything that you would have read in another context. So it was intense in the newness of it. But by the time I got there, we'd had, I think, a series of kind of warm and fuzzy deans of the law school, including, you know, now Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, who turned it into a much, much more pleasant place to be. There were no grades anymore. Everything was just, you know, pass or fail.
Wow. That's totally different. Yeah.
Quite different. So it was intense in that it was new to me, but it wasn't traumatizing by any means, which I think is kind of what 1L suggests that law school can be.
I noticed that you clerked for a district court judge in Massachusetts.
I did.
And that's, I mean, I've talked to people who've clerked. That's a pretty good experience typically, was it for you?
Yes, it was amazing. I loved it. I clerked for Chief Judge Patty Saris in the District of Massachusetts, so up in Boston. And it was just wonderful. I got to spend a year working with her and working with my co-clerks and really just understanding the life of a judge and how cases are decided and helping to do research and writing and contributing to the decisions in all of these cases and helping her sort of sort out the nuts and bolts of the law that was going into everything. I got to work on a couple of really interesting trials. It was wonderful. Clerking was one of the best experiences I had during my legal career. I certainly wouldn't trade that for anything.
And that helps with the writing too, right?
Yes, absolutely. Clerking is a lot of writing, research and writing pretty much. So just kind of taking the papers for each case, you know, the briefs that the attorneys submit and anything else and working your way through them and the research and then doing independent research to get your arms around what the law is, what might be the right outcome for the case, what things to consider, and then serving that all up to the judge in a memo.
So what was your work with, was it University of Pennsylvania?
Yes.
What was the work there?
So at the University of Pennsylvania, I was in their communications department. So I was the senior writer and the managing editor there. So basically, the website for the law school also functions as a bit of a newsroom to report on the things that students are doing, the research professors are doing. So in that role, what I did was write and curate stories about the important things that were going on around campus, which meant I got to spend a lot of time reading professors' really interesting law review articles. I got to talk to students about the cases that they were working on in their clinics. It was a nice pivot point for me between the law and coming fully back to journalism.
How about that time at the Columbia Journalism School? That's one of the couple most prestigious journalism places for education. Was that valuable or no?
It was incredibly valuable. It ended up that I kind of walked away from the career shortly after graduating, but it certainly stayed with me. The education that you get at Columbia is so rigorous, and they just toss you right into the deep end as soon as you get there. You're assigned to a neighborhood in New York City to have as your beat for your year there, and that's where you go and you get your stories and you kind of you get to know the folks in that neighborhood and you know the political issues, the social justice issues, and you just report on it and report on it. And they really give you a strong framework of not just nuts and bolts reporting, but a really solid grounding in ethics, journalistic ethics, the law that works around journalism, around things like defamation, you know, news gathering law, just to make sure you keep yourself out of trouble. I call upon my education there a great deal in my current work.
Did they teach you anything about how to conduct an interview? I've been doing all these interviews for this podcast, and I'm always wondering if I'm missing something in my education about how to do it. What do they say?
I can't remember a specific how to conduct an interview. The one thing that's coming back to me is to try to ask open-ended questions and not yes or no questions, because I think that when you get the most valuable information is when you just let people talk. You ask them a question and allow them to kind of open up, and you hold space for what they want to talk about and pull the threads of what they seem to be interested in. And I think that kind of leads you to the best places. But I couldn't tell you if I got that from Columbia or if that's just something I picked up over the course of my life. But
fair enough. You had mentioned that 2016, I'm assuming the election of Trump and probably not being happy with it, but that's a guess, that was part of driving you in this direction. What was your reaction to that election and what was your lens on it?
Personally, I was horrified. You know, I think...
Me too.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were. Just seeing the way that he conducted himself during the campaign, you know, openly racist, openly sexist, and to see that this is the person that, granted, not a numerical majority, but, you know, an electoral college majority, we'll say, of the country decided to lift up as our leader was horrifying. I wouldn't say it was shocking, but it was horrifying and it wasn't what I expected. So watching that unfold, I think after getting past despair, the question is, well, what am I going to do about it? And certainly there are people who are within the legal profession who are fighting the good fight, you know, as lawyers. And I honor that work. I respect that work a great deal. That just happened to not be my ministry. That's not the kind of law I was really practicing, except a little bit towards the end. So really just kind of returning to my roots as a way to feel grounded in what seemed like a really important moment for people to stand up for things like racial justice and gender justice.
So what did you do?
So I bided my time for a while, but then I started freelancing. I just started writing again, just kind of pitching out stories to different outlets. And I ended up getting a few things published here and there. I did a piece in the Washington Post. I did a couple pieces with CNN, some with Slate, and none of them really have to do with the president personally. I actually don't know that I've ever published a single thing, at least before being at Prism, that had anything to do with Trump as an individual. But just writing about the issues that were important to me and feeling empowered to kind of stand up and talk about those things, that was sort of a motivating factor, I think. Actually, in the midst of freelancing, I also worked briefly at another law firm. And while I was at that law firm, I did get to do some work that's a little bit relevant to the current political situation, which is working on the gerrymandering cases in Pennsylvania that resulted in us getting a new electoral map in time for the 2018 election. So that was great. That was like one of the last things I did before I left the legal profession. So I felt like I left on a high note. I did some freelancing and then shifted to my job at University of Pennsylvania. And then just about a year ago, I joined Prism.
Oh, so I picked up that you became editor-in-chief this summer, but you had joined Prism previously. Did you seek the job? How did you make that connection?
I just sought it out. I was looking around for different jobs in journalism because at that point I was ready after freelancing for a while and being at the University of Pennsylvania, ready to make the leap all the way back over the line, so to speak. So yeah, I just found a job posting and applied for it. It was for the managing editor role at Prism last year and applied and was fortunate enough to be chosen. And ever since, I've been working with the rest of the team to just build out this wonderful, wonderful site, new platform for people of color.
I had talked to Yada, the founder, some time ago when she was getting it going, and she talked about wanting to democratize power, wanting to dispel toxic narratives that are out there. Catch me up on what's been happening at Prism since I talked to her. How's it going in building a team? How is the enterprise doing? What are some of the things that you're proud of that are going on?
Sure. So the thing that I'm most proud of is the amazing team that we've built, a fantastic team of journalists. I think since you spoke with Yada, now we have our full editorial team in place. So that's me. That's our senior editor, Mitchie. We have our electoral justice reporter, Anoa, our senior reporter, Tina Vasquez, who covers gender justice, workers' rights, and immigration, our criminal justice reporter, Tamar, and Carolyn, who's been with us since the beginning, who is our copy editor and also our reporter who covers racial justice and culture. We've kind of got the full dream team in place. So we're really just chugging along at a pretty steady clip, putting out stories that cover the issues that aren't really being covered or aren't being covered in the right way in other places in the media. So I'm just incredibly proud of the team we've been able to build. We've done some really amazing work in a couple of different areas, particularly electoral justice, which is really an important issue at this moment. Noah's been all over everything that's happening in Georgia with voter suppression and voting rights. Tina has been doing some fantastic coverage on immigration, in particular around detained migrant children and the push for what's being called Family Separation 2.0. We had an exclusive story with some of the lawyers who are involved in managing the way that detained children are treated within detention centers and finding out that one of the people who's supposed to be representing these children is actually the one who has been pushing for this family separation policy behind the scenes. And that's gotten picked up a couple of different places. Tamar has been doing fantastic work, particularly around COVID-19 and how it's impacting people who are inside, who are incarcerated right now. And I think what makes our coverage unique there is that we, whenever possible, certainly we center the voices of impacted people, which means people who are incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, but she's really made it a priority to share the way that people inside aren't just a victim of these systems, but they're organizing and they're working from within the prisons to change their circumstances. It's been a lot of really exciting work. It's been a lot of hard work, especially with the pandemic and the uprisings. We've been very, very busy. There's a lot we've had to work with.
I mean, you talked about what makes your coverage unique. Is it hard to find stories that aren't being covered or aren't being covered right, as you put it? Or are there just way too many of them?
There are a lot. There are a lot of untold stories, which some of those are harder to find. But I think what makes our reporters so special and so effective is that they build relationships within the communities that they report on in a way that they're accountable to people and people also trust them. So when something happens, people bring them stories that they might not bring to another reporter or to another outlet. But in terms of finding stories that are being covered elsewhere, but maybe not being covered in the right way, that's really easy. I mean, you know, thinking about the way some elections are covered, this idea that only white male candidates are electable, it's not hard to find outlets that are kind of pushing that narrative. And it's not hard to report things in a way that reflects the leadership of women of color, for example, and how effective we are, you know, when running for office and how effective we can be once in office. So it varies, but what's been really, really nice is seeing the relationships that the reporters are building to be able to bring these stories to light and become trusted go-to outlets for folks in communities of color.
It just strikes me that it must be, in some ways, kind of a dream job for somebody. I read some of your stuff when you were an undergrad, but to be in an organization that has this particular dedication and centers what it centers, does it feel that way?
It does. I say this all the time. This is absolutely my dream job. I don't need another job ever. I'm never going anywhere. I could not have asked for an outlet that was more tailor-made for the things that I think are important and the things that I care about and the kind of work that I love to do. I'm honestly just thrilled every day, even the days that are tough. I'm thrilled.
Well, can you help me illustrate what you do or what your team does a little more? Like, you talked about like writing about electoral justice in Georgia. A reporter, I think it was Anoa. What was the name?
Anoa
Chung. Anoa. Mm-hmm. Tell me about like what is going on there. How is your reporter embedded? Be specific about that story and why you think it brings something different to the media landscape.
Sure. So Anoa, she's based in Georgia. She, I think, lives either in Atlanta or outside Atlanta. So very close, kind of locally, physically, geographically to the issues that are going on. But what's been happening in Georgia, basically since the election that involved Stacey Abrams and even before, is just a longstanding campaign of voter suppression, using these kind of exact match and signature match laws to take people off the voter rolls and just various other ways, closing of polling places, various other ways to disenfranchise people, keep them from voting, make it, you know, logistically almost impossible for them to vote, and so on. And of course, all these tactics are targeted at people of color, communities of color. Anoa is actually, she's relatively new to journalism. She's actually a longtime organizer in this space of electoral justice. So she brings with her a deep understanding of the issues that are happening in Georgia and also happening in electoral justice around the country from her organizing background. And she also brings with her knowledge of who the key players are and a relationship of trust with them, so that when these stories are breaking, organizers in particular and activists are willing to talk to her. So, you know, whereas you might go to another outlet and the main people that they're talking to might be elected officials themselves or, you know, people who are kind of within the halls of power, what we try to do is spend a bit more time focusing on both impacted people, so talking to voters themselves, and talking to people who are outside of the official halls of power, but who are building power in their own communities and taking action outside the system to make change. So that's really what a lot of her stories look like, lifting up the voices of activists and organizers who are not just sitting back and being victimized by voter suppression, but are taking significant action to push for fair voting rights and accessible voting for everyone.
So there was a lot of coverage of a lot of those issues in other publications. Do you see that as a result of the work that you guys are doing? Does that help any of that mainstream coverage change? Do they cite your work? Or is it just, do you see your stuff as sort of additive to the coverage out there?
It's both.
How do you see the impact of what you're doing?
I see it both ways, actually. That's a really great question. I see it both ways, especially as we get more sort of well-known. People kind of know we're here and know to look for us, look to us for coverage. We are seeing that kind of impact that you're talking about, where other outlets are picking up our work and reporting on it and citing us, which is important because, you know, when you're kind of the first to report a story, you get to frame and shape the narrative in a different way than if you come to it later. So a really strong example of this is Tina's recent story on the immigration attorney who's been quietly pushing for this family separation policy in the background. That was picked up in a lot of different outlets. I think the Wall Street Journal, CBS, NBC, we saw it a few different places. So that was an exclusive story that Tina reported out. And again, that's thanks to her longstanding relationships with lawyers who are in the immigration law space. So they were willing to come to her because they trust her, because she's been an immigration reporter for so long and, you know, feels close to those communities and accountable to those communities. So they brought that story to her, and then our reporting was kind of picked up, and then it became a story in the larger media. So that's one way that we're having an impact, is sort of to disseminate and kind of set the narrative for others. But at the same time, our coverage can also be additive because people can come directly to us. They can come directly to our website and read the story, you know, right from the source if they want to. So we're adding something different to the media landscape, and at the same time, hopefully changing the way that other actors are doing their work as well.
How do you think about election? You know, we're approaching this November Trump reelect. And there's just going to be so much I don't know, dust thrown up in the air and worse between now and then. How do you think about the news of the day and the rush towards the election when your focus seems to be on pieces of the political world and cultural world, but not necessarily this big event, but something that's going to have just tremendous impact on everything that's going on?
Right. So thinking about the election for our coverage, what we really want to do is be a space for people to find useful information about what's happening electorally right now. And that might seem like a very obvious, intuitive thing for a journalistic outlet to want to do. But if you look at the way that the election's covered in a lot of places, it's actually not. Horse race coverage of who's ahead, who's behind, who got in trouble for saying XYZ, you know, who's up, who's down, who's speaking at the convention. That's not really information that voters can do anything with. That's not terribly useful. It might be interesting. It might be a little bit entertaining if you look at politics as sort of a game. But if you're looking to the electoral system to be a potential vehicle for justice, first of all, people need to be able to have their votes counted. So what we're primarily going to be focusing on around the election are issues of electoral justice. So there's, you know, widespread voter suppression campaigns going on right now. You know, the United States Postal Office is currently being, I don't think tampered with really captures the magnitude of what's going on. I mean, basically being financially gutted as a way to keep people from voting safely in the pandemic. So we're really going to be looking to ways to help people better understand the landscape and better understand what they can do in their own communities to work towards electoral justice and make sure that their voices are heard in this election and point them to the people who are doing work on the front lines to make sure that that's happening.
The Democratic ticket is considerably more diverse than the Republican ticket after the VP pick, but there's complicated views about it in minority communities, I think, at least in portions of them. How do you view where that sits in the political landscape right now? Issues around race and gender and this ticket?
I think it's important, and I don't want to set aside how meaningful this moment is for Black women in particular. It does mean something. It's really special. It's historic to have a Black woman being on a presidential ticket. That's just not something that's previously happened. So that matters. Representation of this kind matters. And frankly, I would be very surprised and also appalled if the Democrats ever fielded an all-white ticket ever again, or if they ever fielded an all-male ticket ever again. There's no reason why that should ever happen. So this is certainly a step in the right direction representation-wise. But of course, there are conversations to be had about the records of both candidates. You know, people rightfully have some questions about where Joe Biden and Kamala Harris stand on things like criminal justice. So you can hold both ideas in your mind at the same time, that this moment is wonderful and a historic moment for representation and honoring the contributions of Black women to Democratic politics in particular. But that doesn't mean that people from all directions within the party aren't going to try to push these candidates substantively to the places where they think they need to go.
Now that you're editor-in-chief, and it's been a fairly short time, have you started to, or do you have intention to sort of change the organization in any way to put your own stamp on it? Or do you think it's in the right place? Or what's the vision going forward?
I think we're largely in the right place. So I want to mostly keep us on the path that we're on. My hope as editor-in-chief is just to make sure that more people know what we're doing, that more people have access to the really important coverage that we're doing, that more people start thinking about the news in a different way through the way that we present it, really just lifting up the importance of women of color, people of color who are in journalism and continuing to do that work and using Prism as a platform to hopefully reshape what the industry looks like.
What is the reach of the publication right now?
So right now, there are a couple of different ways to think about our reach. So we have distribution partnerships, including one with Daily Coast, which reaches, I think, something like 16 million people a month. So there's a fairly wide reach in the sense that our stories are posted there. You know, every story of ours is posted there. And the other thing that's most exciting is that we actually just launched our new website. So now we're kind of getting our website up and running and we're building up our reach for people to kind of directly come to us rather than seeing our stories elsewhere.
And that's ourprism.org?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Beyond that distribution partnership, what other things are you trying to do to get more people to know about you? And to what degree is that part of your job, or how does that fit into your leadership?
Well, kind of being at the helm, it kind of makes everything my job a little bit. But we do have a wonderful digital communications manager, Vicente Garcia, who handles most of this kind of work. And a lot of it is, you know, making sure we're pushing out our stories on social media, which has been really, really great. Everybody can follow us at Prism Reports, and that's on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram. But the other ways are looking at new ways to tell stories. We're particularly interested in working on moving into doing more video, kind of live conversations and live panels, which have become a big feature of kind of COVID-19 America. So we'll certainly be partaking in that. So just giving people more access to ways to have entry points for the reporting that we're doing, finding people where they are.
How do you see where Prism fits into the media landscape? What are the organizations, the other media that it's adjacent to? How does it team up? How does it fit in?
I think part of it is that we're coming into a landscape that has a really long, proud lineage of people of color, Black-led news. So certainly coming into an existing landscape of other organizations that have been doing this work for a long time and really just thrilled to be here. And then at the same time, there are other nonprofit news organizations that do work that's similar to ours. So we can kind of stand next to them. So sort of Black-led media, people of color-led media, I'm thinking of places like Color Lines, Zora Magazine, The Griot, The Root. And then for nonprofits, you know, you have places like The Marshall Project that's doing great work in criminal justice. The 19th, which recently launched, which is doing journalism focused on women in the United States. So there are a lot of different kind of places where we fit in, I think, and a lot of great opportunities for us to work with other organizations.
When you look at those sort of organizations, do you see things that you want to crib? I don't mean necessarily in articles, but in sort of direction or learnings that they have. Do you meet with them, or do you sort of keep to yourself and go your own way?
Prism has kind of a unique way of doing things ourselves, just the way that we tell stories, the sources that we choose to talk to. So I wouldn't tweak it too much, but you know, like anybody else, I think I certainly see things that I like in other places. And I make a note, the head of digital content at The Griot actually is a good friend of mine from college, Natasha Alford. So I talk to her pretty frequently, and they do video over there really well. So, you know, just having a chance to learn from other folks who are in the journalism industry, who I may have connections with or make connections with now that I'm in this role, that's an opportunity that I take really seriously, because there's always something for us to learn from one another. And hopefully there are things people can learn from the way Prism does our work. And yeah, the more of us who are out here doing this work, the better.
What's your biggest challenge right now?
My biggest challenge right now. Mine or Prism's?
Either, both.
I'm a mother.
See, the open-ended question that you've recommended.
I'm a mother of two, so I have a 3-year-old and an 11-month-old. So,
oh yeah, you got a big challenge.
Yeah, so dealing with full-time, you know, work and parenting, you know, of course with my husband, and we have a ton of help, but I think working parents right now are in a bit of a struggle, just kind of nationwide.
Oh, especially with the little ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Super little. Super little. So that's my biggest personal challenge, I would say, right now. For Prism, kind of institutionally, I'd say the biggest challenge is just getting our arms around the moment. And we're certainly trying to rise to the moment, but there's just so much news that we need to cover. So much that's happening. We've got the uprisings, you know, the movement for Black Lives. We've got the pandemic. Now we've got this upcoming election, which appears to be in the process of being stolen before our eyes. So there's quite a lot. And, you know, we're a dedicated staff. We're a staff of amazing, wonderful, hardworking people, but there aren't that many of us. The editorial team is just, there's just 6 of us. You know, we have 4 reporters and 2 editors. So we do what we can do, and we have a wonderful freelance program, so we can bring in additional voices and additional people to report stories for us and write opinion columns and commentary. So we're doing the most with what we have, but it's a lot. And I think in some ways it never feels like it's enough.
On the subject of the uprisings, I think there's this combination of reactions. There's so much hope that it's engendering that we may make significant steps forward as a result. And there's also some fear that some aspects of the uprising might create backlash that's not helpful politically. How do you see this sorting out, and what are your hopes?
I can see the truth in both sides of what you said. I don't think there's ever been a movement for racial justice in the United States that hasn't provoked some sense of backlash. And I mean, that's going back to, like, you know, the 1800s. So I can see that. On the other hand, we're already in the midst of a bit of backlash. In some ways, many ways, this entire moment is backlash to the Obama administration. That's what the Trump administration is. It's the embodiment of backlash to the fact that we had a Black president. So I don't know that I worry too much about a backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement, because that backlash will come and it'll be dealt with, because it always comes. But I do think there's a tremendous opportunity in this moment. And there are a lot of reasons to hope, both with the uprisings and the combination of the uprisings and the pandemic. Our society, no matter what we do, is not going to look anything like it did before once all of this is over. So recognizing that we're in a moment of transformation, I think the most important thing, and you know what PRISM is trying to do, is be a platform for people of color who are at the intersections of some of these things, you know, being most impacted by the pandemic, being at the forefront of the uprisings, to really be the ones who are leading the process of envisioning what the future needs to look like. So I think, you know, if we listen to the right people, we pursue the right policies, there's a good chance that we can make some significant progress from this moment. I do think so.
Yeah, I agree. I have such a hard time wrapping my head around the notion of backlash to Obama, because he struck me as such a intelligent, honorable, good exemplar of leadership. And yet it's pretty clear that everything Trump is permeated by some feeling that, you know, starting with that birtherism, the illegitimacy, there just seemed to be a visceral dislike by Trump of Obama, which is hard to really grasp. And it's so strange to understand that that is fairly widespread in the populace. What do you see in terms of backlash towards our former president?
I mean, I think a lot of it is personal to Trump. I mean, I don't know if you could imagine somebody who's more of a personal opposite to what Barack Obama was than Donald Trump. But he wasn't lifted up to the Oval Office on the strength of just his own personal animus for Barack Obama. You know, it took a lot of voters who were willing to take that journey with him. And I think to some extent, for a wide swath of the largely, you know, white voting population, the mere fact of Black leadership just provokes some kind of an existential crisis about the future of this country, the racial power balance in this country. I think around the same time Obama was elected, there was a lot of reporting around what's been called the browning of America. You know, the fact that at some point in the not too distant future, white folks won't be a numerical majority anymore. They'll still be a plurality, but not a majority. There's real fear there and a willingness to act upon that fear in a way that looks like what we have right now. I don't know what to do about it. You know,
I mean, it really does seem like the president, his theory of politics seems to involve continually playing this race and gender and divisiveness card. And he's going to it every day now in a more and more blatant way, or as blatant as his most blatant moments. It's just a hard country to live in to see that.
It is. I mean, it's not surprising that he's going to it every day now. It's literally the only card he has left to play at this point.
He could play a good government card. He could try to turn around his COVID team. It's conceivable that he could do it. He just doesn't seem to have it in him.
No, he does not. This seems to be in some ways the sum total of what he has within him and what the government underneath him has to offer. I'm not expecting a big turn. I'm not expecting, I think I've seen a bunch of stories in various moments of his presidency. You know, this is the moment when Trump became president. He's taking his tone, he's taking it more seriously now. It's like, all right, guys, how many times are we going to, you know, let Lucy take the football away before we gonna accept that this is just who he is? This is what this administration is. There's nothing else that it has to offer.
Is there a question about PRISM that I haven't asked that you'd like to answer?
I don't think so. I've had a chance to talk about all the work that we're doing and really what we're about. So no, I don't think so.
Well, it's really been an honor to talk to you, to hear your story and to hear what you guys are up to. Anything else you want to say?
I think the only other thing that I want to say is, well, first, thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And just to encourage everybody who's interested in reading amazing journalism produced by women of color to head over to ourprism.org and see what we're all about and follow us on social media at Prism Reports and Instagram. But yeah, that's it. Just look to Prism for coverage of this important moment.
Ashton, thank you so much for the work you're doing out there.
Thanks so much, Nathaniel.
That was Ashton Lattimore at PRISM. You can find her at ourprism.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. By the way, if you're a listener, I'm always interested in feedback. Please email me at nperlman@gmail.com.